Hey, this is Mark Kassoff, and this is RPM 45. In this episode, the odyssey of Gary Puckett. From his beginnings in music, to the Union Gap's string of gold records, to the tough times that followed, and how he came through it all a successful man. Here's our talk with Gary Puckett. I heard you say you got your voice from your parents.
I did. They were both good singers, great singers, as a matter of fact. I was just lucky to inherit the combined qualities, you know, of their voices.
Which is awesome, yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So were you singing as a kid all the time then, too?
Well, I was, but I didn't have any idea, you know, that I could sing. I just knew that I liked to sing because I grew up through the rock and roll era. And that included Little Richard and Elvis Presley and the Everly Brothers and, you know, other rockers of the time. I always considered myself a rock and roller, you know, not a balladeer. And it really wasn't until much later in life that I really realized that my thing really was ballad, not rocking. But what can I say? I was very lucky, you know, to inherit the qualities of their voices. And these days, I'm still in pretty good voice. I haven't sung for about 7 months now. So I'm going to have to, you know, start exercising and rehearsing my chords. You know?
Are you missing it?
I am. Really, I am. I've got a great band and we all miss each other as friends, you know, because we love to hang out together and play music together. I'm very fortunate to have three guys that are just really phenomenal musicians, readers, players, teachers, and they make me sound good.
I'm sure you make them sound really good too. So even though your parents were musicians, what I read is they encouraged you to go to college.
Well, they did. They wanted me to go on to higher education. I was the first child out of five. They always aspired for their children to do better than they did.
So you were in San Diego in college. Had your family moved down to San Diego then?
Yeah, I graduated in Twin Falls in 1960. Tells you my age. This month I will turn 78 years old.
Yeah, I must say, and I would like to maybe later get into your health regimen because you look damn good.
Oh, thank you. You need glasses. Well, let's see. What was I saying now? I graduated from high school in Twin Falls, 1960, and my dad had taken a job that he was offered in San Diego. And I started all general courses, and I just kept thinking, it's more fun to do music. I'd rather be playing guitar, you know. I'd rather be singing a song or two. And there just came a point after a couple of years where I said, I've had enough school. I'm going to go for the music business and try to make it a reality for me, try to make it a success.
What's the path from you saying, screw college, to becoming Gary Puckett in the Union Gap? How does that work?
Well, I had been in little groups, you know, in the San Diego area. So we did that for a while. And then I ended up in a group that was pretty good. We were called the Outcasts. It was a trio that was put together by a club owner in San Diego. He found us in a club working and he said, I really like you guys. And we just went, well, okay, that's cool. And that was the era of Go-Go Girls.
Should bring that back just for fun.
In its innocence, it was cool. It was a lot of fun. We ended up working in a number of clubs that they went a little bit beyond the go-go, you know, and they were topless and stuff like that. And we just would always go, oh, no, not again.
You know? I miss that. I must have been in the wrong places.
It was a little disconcerting to try to keep your face toward the microphone when there's a half-naked girl dancing right next to you. You know what I mean?
Yes. And it was rock and roll music, basically. It was.
Oh yeah, R&B and rock and roll, and the people wanted to dance, you know, and that's what it was. They had the sparkle ball in the middle of the dance floor, and you know, it was set up like a normal club with a stage and a dance floor and a bar on either end of the room, and they had girls running drinks, and they had the two go-go girls who we loved. They were really terrific ladies. Nothing unseemly about it. They were just beautiful and danced well, and it drew crowds. So we did that for a couple of years, and there came a point when the bass player and the drummer were always kind of at odds, and I always took exception to that, because we made incredible money for being local musicians, because we were drawing crowds every night of the week, and it was raucous, you know, it was just a lot of fun. But Tommy and Bobby being at odds all the time, I finally said to them, guys, you know, I think I'm going to move on, because you're always arguing. You're always fighting about something, you know, arguing over who's the leader, who's going to call the songs. So at some point I went ahead and left. That was when I started looking around San Diego to see if I could find people that would want to be in a group and allow me to be the leader. I didn't know how to be a leader. I just wanted to have success in the music business. So I said, okay, guys, here's what I want to do. And they said, okay, let's see if we can do that. That was the beginning of a group that I called Gary and the Remarkables. We worked in the Quadroom for, I don't know, a couple of months. And at that point, I went and found a little agent up in Los Angeles. He put us to work up in Seattle, then down in Portland, then in Vallejo, California. And it was during our stay in Seattle that I got the idea for the Union Soldier outfits and the name Union Gap, because I had grown up close to Union Gap in Yakima Valley.
Union Gap is a town.
Union Gap is a town. It just occurred to me that using the Union Soldier outfits, the word Union made sense to me. Union Soldier, Union Gap, I got it, guys. They thought that was the stupidest thing they ever heard. And they joked and they laughed, you know, and I said, just keep laughing. That's what we're going to do. And I think it kind of scared them a little bit, because they didn't want to dress in costumes. And we went to Portland. From there, we went to Vallejo. And after we left Vallejo, I took the guys and went to Western Costume in Los Angeles and said, I want to buy outfits that are Union Soldier outfits. And they said, okay. And they quoted me some figure that was just amazing. And of course, we didn't have enough between us to buy one outfit. So I rented one outfit and I took the guys and went to Tijuana, Mexico, and found a little tailor down there. He made these great outfits for us. And from there, there's a little place outside of San Diego, at least there was then. It had a saloon and a jail and a kind of a main street and a cemetery. And it was a little tourist place, you know. So we went there, took lots of pictures with the saloon girls and with the sheriff. And I put together a whole portfolio and put it in an actual fold-out, you know, with lyrics to songs I had written and a demo of the band I was in prior, which was the Outcasts. And took it around to all the record companies in Los Angeles until I finally found a guy by the name of Jerry Fuller, who, when I looked in his door, was pounding a nail in the wall. He was hanging up a gold record. I said, excuse me. And he turned around. And he says, hey, come on in, man. So I walked in, and you could tell that his office was not in disarray. He was putting it together because he was a brand new employee at Columbia Records. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm hanging up a gold record. And I said, really? I've never seen one of those before. Can I see it up close? So he hung it up and I walked up to it and looked at it. And I can recall just standing there looking at it going, oh my gosh, that's Ricky Nelson. That's Traveling Man. He said, yeah, I wrote it for Sam Cooke, but Sam didn't want it. So Ricky's people heard it, took it to Ricky. Ricky loved it. It sold 4 million copies, and here I am.
Wow. The rest is history.
I said, please, please, look at my portfolio, please.
So you hook up with him, and he becomes your producer.
That's right. Well, he said, where do I see the band, after we had, you know, a nice little chat that afternoon. And I told him where. He said, I'll come down on Saturday night. And he showed up actually the night before, unannounced, and walked up to the stage at midnight. And since I didn't expect him, I almost didn't recognize him. He just looked up at me and said, let's go make a record.
Oh, wow.
And I awesome. Went, maybe something's finally starting to happen. But he said, I'll be back, you know, in 4, 6, 8 weeks, something, however long it takes me to get the recording and publishing papers together and all that, you know. So he came back, I don't know, a month and a half later, something like that, and said, I've got the papers. Let's go out and sit in the bowling alley and sign.
Did you have representation?
No, not until after, actually. Had I known better, you know, that they were such sharks out there, I would have gone and gotten representation. But fortunately, Columbia Records is not so shark infested that they cheated me. You know, they didn't give us the best deal, but they gave us a fair deal. Jerry said, I'm all set. We're going to record on August 17th. That was 1967. Here's the song. It's going to sound a little bit different when we're done with it. It was a country song written by two country boys from Nashville, and they had recorded as a country record. Woman, woman, have you got cheating now in your mind? And so Jerry says, I'm not going to sing the line for you right now because it's morning and I just don't sound right doing it. But anyway, whoa, woman, that one, you know.
Wow. That's a highlight right there for this thing.
Well, thank you very much. You're welcome. So anyway, we made it a pop record. And, you know, the boys in the band weren't really crazy about it because it wasn't rock and roll. And it seemed like a holdover from the big band era. But that's what Jerry was. He was a singer, songwriter. And records to him should be the song first, the singer next, the arrangement next. You know, he wanted a song to be a hit song, regardless of who sang it, regardless of who produced it or arranged it.
So it becomes a top five hit.
Yeah, it stayed up there in the top five for, I think, 6 weeks, and ultimately sold about 1.5 million copies and started us on the trajectory. And Jerry, being the smart producing songwriting guy that he was and still is, Jerry and I are in touch, not daily, but though we had differences back then, we're in touch and we kind of smoothed that all out. Jerry wrote Young Girl, which followed on the heels and was a smash.
Was that the biggest?
I'd say that it was the biggest, but I could be wrong. Lady Willpower was so close on its heels and sold as many records. We start the show with Lady Willpower because all I have to do is go, Lady, and put the microphone out and the people sing the rest of the song, you know.
So you had 6 gold records.
In a row.
In a row.
Which they say nobody else has done since, I can't remember who. They would say even Elvis didn't do that. Even the Beatles didn't do that. I don't know.
I heard that in 68 you actually outsold the Beatles.
Well, that's what they say. I'm going to wear that little badge proudly. But between you and me, I just go, how could you outsell the Beatles? How could you? I know that we sold that year about 16 million singles alone. And I know they were starting to have a bit of a breakup. And I know that there were chinks in the bricks, so to speak, you know, but still, I'll wear the badge, like I said.
Absolutely, wear it. So what's it like? I mean, here you go from being this bar band to having 6 gold records, 5 of them top 5 records. What's that like? I mean, you're a young guy, you're what, 25 years old or something like that, and you're in your mid-20s. You go from the bar band to these huge records, and for 2 years you're dominating. I mean, you're blasting out of the radios all over the country. It's unbelievable.
Well, it was, and it was exactly that. And at times I think that I thought it was unbelievable, but it was sometimes overwhelming. In 1968, if my memory serves me correctly, which it doesn't always, but I remember this number, we did 268 show days.
Wow.
That's a lot of show days out of 365.
Yeah.
We were on the road the entire year. There was just no getting home except for maybe a day or two, but it was overwhelming. It was faster than heck. You know, it was, I don't know. It was an adventure that's just really hard to describe in a lot of ways because, you know, there were all the things that people who desire success have at their availability. Fortunately, I didn't get too involved with drugs. I did like marijuana and I smoked my share of it, you know, mm-hmm. But fortunately, I didn't get off that path too far and destroy my life or my health with all that stuff. And obviously I haven't smoked since way back in the 80s, but still everything was there. Everything was available, the partying, the girls, the this, the that, everything that you do. And I think that I sort of lost my mind, if that's a good way to put it, quote unquote, for a year or two. And finally I just sort of woke up one day and said, that's not who I am, you know, so let's get back on track here and find myself again and be the Gary that I seem to remember growing up with, you know. So it put me in a good place. And here I am all these years later with a wonderful little family and, you know, still success because I'm fortunate to have all the fans out there.
So I want to ask you a little bit about the lyrics of some of these songs. And you did not write these songs. Let me make that clear. Okay.
I didn't write the hits, no.
You didn't write the hits. Young Girl, Get Out of My Mind. My Love for You is Way Out of Line. Run, Girl, Because I'm Afraid We'll Go Too Far. Jerry Fuller wrote that song.
Yes, he did. And in his mind, the guy in the song was above board. In my mind, the guy was also above board because he's telling the girl, look, beneath your perfume and your makeup, you're just a baby in disguise, but I couldn't see that. You led me to believe that you're old enough, but I see now that you're not. So you've got to go away. I have to get you out of my mind. So he was an upstanding guy. We got so much flack about it in those days.
Did you? Oh, I heard WLS almost didn't play it. I'm from Chicago. So WLS in Chicago almost didn't play it because of the lyrics.
Well, and you know why they played it? Because CKLW jumped on it immediately. I was there the moment that we took it to WLS in my little hand. And I said, here's the new one, you know. And they said, oh, boy. And they put it right on the air. And then for whatever reason said, oh, we can't have this. I'm afraid we'll go too far kind of stuff on the airwaves. And they said, we're not going to play this. But then CKLW played it and played it a lot. So LS, I think, finally jumped on it. But we got a lot of flack throughout the years, you know, for those songs being, what's this unrequited love thing, they would say, you know. And I'd go, I don't know. They're hit songs. What do you care? Let's sing them. Let's have fun.
It wasn't the only song of the era that had, you know, those kind of issues.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The Rolling Stones, Let's Spend the Night Together. And then when they went on Ed Sullivan, it had to be Let's Spend Some Time Together.
But you know what? I think he said, let's spend the night together anyway.
He was supposed to. You're right. Yes. Yes. Well, wait, here's another Jerry Fuller song, Lady Willpower, right? Mm-hmm. Did no one tell you the facts of life? There's so much you have to learn, and I would gladly teach you. If I could only reach you and get your loving in return. Come on.
All right. Well, okay. That one goes over the line.
And what about This Girl Is a Woman Now? Now, what is that about?
To me, that's just a coming of age song.
Oh, okay.
You know, we're all people, you know. Some of us come of age sooner than others. And, you know, the basic human instinct is to procreate. But, you know, when we're younger and hormones are raging, we aren't thinking about procreating. We're just thinking about the process of it, you know. So I just thought of it as a song. See, when I did that song, let's see, I turned 26. So I was married. I was not a virgin, you know. So I don't know. I'm only defending the songs in so much as that to me is a coming of age song. That's
okay.
It.
Okay. It's only those of us whose mind may stray, like myself.
And you know, things never change. So it doesn't matter how old you get, minds still continue to stray.
Absolutely right. So you're huge. You got all these hits. You played at the White House, at the Nixon White House.
Mm-hmm.
And you played for Prince Charles and
Princess Anne.
Princess Anne, yes. And you played with the Guess Who. They also
correct.
Played at the same time. Which
that's correct.
I have to ask this question about the Guess Who. Did they sing American Woman?
I don't think they did, as a matter of fact. I'm pretty sure the song was either censored or it was thrown out of the show.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I just wondered if they crossed that line.
You know, I think that Burton Cummings was a good enough man to say, okay, I'm going to go by their wishes, you know, because he wasn't the Rolling Stones. I mean, the Stones were known for their below the belt kind of approach to life.
Yes. Well, it served them pretty well. But now, okay, so after all these hits, and you guys break with Jerry Fuller. Do I have that story?
Yeah, we broke with him only because I thought I knew better than Jerry. And in retrospect, that was stupid. It was not good thinking on my part. I should have just said, Jerry, continue. I'll sing whatever you want me to sing. Uh-huh. In retrospect, that sounds like the right thing to do. He had brought us millions of sales. He had brought us many gold records, but I didn't like the song. And the reason was this. When we did Don't Give In to Him, I wasn't sure that that was right for us. It only went up to about 12, maybe 15 in the pop charts. Yeah, and I kind of went, well, you see, Jer, maybe I am not too stupid about these things. And then he said, well, we're going to do another song. I've looked through 2,000 songs, and he wrote a song called Heaven Down Below, and I just took exception to it. And we were to show up for the recording session, which we did, but I said, I don't want to do this song. I just should have done it. I just should have done it, but I didn't. And that was the parting of the ways. That set me off on a wandering path. I thought I would come back and all would be well, but I had a meeting with Jack Gold, who was the West Coast A&R guy. And he said, Gary, basically, these weren't his words, but Gary, shut up and sing and let us make you rich and famous. And I said, well, I'm going to take a little time off. I'm going to songwrite. I'm going to come back and we're going to do this again. And it'll be my songs that are hits and all that kind of stuff, which never happened because it was now 1970. The era was changing. We were coming into Bang a Gong, you know, David Bowie, Spiders from Mars, disco, all that stuff. The Vietnam War was forefront in our minds. We were seeing a war fought on television in front of our faces, and things just went away. As a side note to that, all these years later, I hear from the Vietnam veterans, you don't know what your music meant to us then,
mm-hmm.
which is a wonderful thing. And I always do my tribute to the veterans of all wars, but still.
Well, I know you sang this song Home.
Correct. We still do that in the show.
I have to admit to you, I had never heard that song till this morning when I said, I want to listen to this. It's a great song, and your version of it is beautiful. Whose song is that originally?
Larry Collins was a songwriter, and he got together with Mac Davis. They wrote that song. I love the song Home, so we did it. And it remains in my show, every show that I do, because I want to let the veterans know they're loved and cared for.
Did anyone ever have a hit record with that song?
No.
That surprises me.
Yeah, and it surprises me too. And I would have thought that somebody would have come along from the big country guys, for instance, that would have taken that song unto themselves. But maybe God being good, he said, this is your song, Gary, and I'm going to keep it yours.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic. So you break up with the group then in early 70s as well.
Yeah. Eventually, I just stopped touring because nobody was hiring Gary Puckett and the Union Gap anymore. 1972, 3, and times got kind of bleak.
And it seems like the 70s, the whole decade, was a tough time for you.
Very, very tough. Very tough. I didn't work publicly. You know, records weren't selling well. I just did what I could to survive. I don't know how to explain it beyond that. You know, royalties were minimal, but there were some coming in. But mostly fans now turned left and went off into glitter rock, disco, all that kind of stuff, and the protests and the Vietnam War and all those things. And only a few of the 60s artists really survived, and that would have been people like Paul Simon, Stevie Wonder. You know, you can probably think of a couple more, but we didn't survive that somehow, you know, and I found myself just really sort of ostracized from the business. And I kept songwriting and I kept studying and kept doing what I could do. Studied dance for a couple of years, studied acting for a couple of years, went to the Philippine Islands, made a film over there, had the lead role, wrote all the music. But those things just disappeared from view. They didn't really become anything except a great experience. I spent 6 months in the Philippine Islands, enjoyed every minute of it. I even shed a tear leaving the country, but at the same time knew I had to get back home and couldn't spend the rest of my life in Southeast Asia.
It's got to be so tough to, you went through like this 2-year period where everything you touch turned to gold, literally.
Yeah.
To then the 70s. And how did you end up coping with that? What did you do? How did you survive that?
Well, part of it I attribute to the meditational processes that I started in. I don't recall where I was or what the situation was, but I ran into some people that were transcendental meditationists.
I did that too in the 70s.
Yeah, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
Mid-70s, it was a very big thing.
Well, because of the Beatles, obviously. You know, they were huge into that stuff. I found myself saying, well, you know, I'll read about that. I read about it. I thought, well, I wonder, you know, is this good for me? I went to a meeting and I said, I'm going to give this a try. I was initiated and started the meditation. And for 10 years, I meditated in my bedroom, in a taxi, in San Diego, in New York City, in Manila, Philippines, in the jungles, at the beach. It didn't matter where it was, morning and evening. I went to many of their advances, as they called them, where you would round and do the pranayams, the breathing exercises. And
I didn't get that far, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, though. At the end, here's what happened. I was sitting in a house in Beechwood Canyon in Los Angeles, and I'm sitting there on my bedroom floor on my little pillow in my half lotus, because my body isn't built for lotus position. And I'm meditating, and it's going back and forth from the mantra to what am I going to have for lunch to the mantra. And God spoke to me and said, walk away from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and I will show you the way. And the meditation people said, never just open your eyes and get up and walk away. The voice said, walk away from Maharishi. So I just stopped. I went, did I hear that? I heard that. It was a real voice. It was in my head. It wasn't from outside. I don't remember how long it was, but weeks, even months, Christian situations, all that was put in front of me constantly, just almost like a battlefield. I finally went, okay, I'm getting out of Los Angeles. I'm going back to San Diego. And as I'm driving, that voice is going, go to Horizon in Claremont, go to Horizon. Well, I ended up living 6 minutes from one of the Calvary Chapel types, but it kept telling me to go to Horizon.
What is that?
It's a church. It's Calvary Chapel, Chuck Smith, well-known pastor, a well-known non-denominational faith. So I ultimately went to Horizon, which was 30 minutes from my house. And I remember one day standing at the door as they were having prayer, because they didn't let people walk in during prayer. I just stood there and I felt these eyes on me. So I looked over and I see this lady that I know from back when, and we had worked together. Her name then was Lori Beebe. It's now Lori Beebe Lewis. And she sang with the Mamas and the Papas. And she just was beaming with this smile on her face. I looked at her and she said, hi, come here. You know, she gave me a big hug. She said, I'm so glad you're here. That was it. Finally, Pastor Leo Giovanetti came out to my little apartment. It was February. It was pretty cold in San Diego. We got in the swimming pool, which was freezing. And I was baptized. And I've had faith ever since.
When was this?
It was 85 when I was told to stand up. It was not until 91 that I actually said, okay, I give up. I'm here. Take me. And that's it.
The 80s was like a turning point for you.
Yeah, yeah, it was, because throughout the 70s was tough. But into the 80s, I started working in a band in San Diego. I worked in a duo where I played acoustic, he played electric. We sang everything from the Beatles to Buddy Holly. We just had a great time working in the clubs. And then I got into another band in San Diego. And then I started getting calls from disc jockeys and people and agents out there saying, hey, we're starting to hear from the people of our era. They want to hear the music again. So you remember well how the stations started to proliferate, you know,
absolutely,
and
right.
Grow in numbers. So I started to go back out on the road a little bit. Then I was invited to do a big concert at the Meadowlands in New Jersey. A guy came to me backstage and said, my boss would love to talk to you. And I said, who is that? And he gave me his name. And he said, he's working with the Turtles in the association. And I said, oh, really? Got together with him. And he said, I'd like to work with you as well. And I said, okay. And then sometime later, I said, why don't you put the three of us out on the road together? They bring their crowd. I'll bring mine, blah, blah, blah.
That was your idea?
Yeah. He said, sounds good. Let's add somebody to that. I said, well, do what you're going to do. They added Spanky from Spanky and our gang. 84, they put out the very first Happy Together tour, and we worked 8 months of that year. Didn't know how to do it. It was by hook or by crook, you know, but they booked the venues, and each group was responsible for getting themselves there. And they put together a crew with some gear in 8 months worth of concerts, and it was a wild success.
And I read that you also were on the Flower Power tour.
Oh, yeah, that's a cruise.
Yeah, cruise, right.
It's a great cruise.
Yeah, it sounded like a great time.
Absolutely wonderful. They have music from morning till night. They rent the whole ship, you know, so it's not like they have cruisers on the ship that aren't a part of the group. And they bring a plethora of great, great artists. Last time we were on, we had Ides of March and Chuck Negron and me and my band. Who else? The Buckinghams. You could get into it, believe me.
I'm sure I would get into it. Yeah. That's my teenage years, you know?
Google it. You'll probably find the Flower Power Cruise.
Well, so what's up? I mean, obviously, we're all stuck inside, but what's your plans going forward?
Well, you know, we keep moving dates that we had scheduled for this year into next year. And even a lot of them are going into 22 just because everybody's scrambling to get their dates. I had a tour of Australia all planned for this February. It got moved to 2022. We have a lot of dates for 21. That's coming up. I've just discovered a couple of recordings from my past that a writer who has had big, big success told me just the other day. He said, these songs are incredible, and you sang your absolute butt off, and these should be hits now. I'm remixing them. So I'll only say that much because you never know. You know, the minute you start talking too much about stuff and they don't happen, then people go, well, what happened to the blah, blah, blah? I have a new CD out. Well, it's not new. It's old, but it's a new CD for me in so much as I put it together called Love Songs. And it's all songs from the 80s. Journey, Foreigner, Heart, other big ballads that are mostly the rockers' ballads. And I'm pretty proud of it. I did a good job. Played all the guitar on it. And it's a nice little project. So,
How can people get that?
The website has got it, GaryPuckettMusic.com. What else is coming up right now? I'm just concerned about in my little house and my little family and getting my exercise. My wife is very good at nutrition. That's a part of the question that I never answered to you.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that.
Back in the 70s, I got this real health consciousness because one day I noticed that the cost of meat went up twice. It went from, let's say, just for sake of discussion, $1 a pound to $2 a pound. Uh-huh. And I went, that's wrong. You can't do that. I started boycotting meat. Then I started reading, and then I started learning about nutrition. And then I started learning about water, and I started drinking distilled water. Mm. So for 20 years back then, I drank nothing but distilled water, stayed away from sugar, salt, pepper, chemicals of any kind. I was an obnoxious vegetarian in a sense, you know. I wasn't really a vegetarian, but I really adhered to a nutritional path. And I think it served me well. I still drink a ton of water and get my exercise. We fortunately live on the beach here in Clearwater. We walk 2.5 miles down and 2.5 back, and that's a really wonderful walk. And I like to swim. That's more my exercise now. I was totally into bodybuilding for about 5 years, and I was able to gain some weight because I never weighed more than 138 pounds until I was 40 years old.
That's amazing. Dad, you are a skinny guy.
Well, now I weigh 175, so I'm not so skinny anymore.
But, oh, you're still pretty skinny compared to... How tall are you?
I mean, anyway.
How tall are you?
I was 6 feet, but I think after all the bodybuilding and the years of gravity, it's like 5'11".
Yeah, I know how that is, too. Yeah. Yeah. No, you seem like you're in great shape. And I don't know if I'm going to let my wife listen to this podcast because she's going to get on me. You're making me look bad. All right. Well, listen, it's been so great talking with you. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Well, I appreciate it. You are a good interviewer because you know how to have a discussion. You know, you make it fun. We got to laugh. Whether I'm interesting or not doesn't make any difference to me because I had a good time.
You are, and I appreciate your saying that. I do.
All right. God bless. Thanks. You, my friend.
You too.
Take care.
Thanks so much to Gary Puckett. I really enjoy talking with him. And in fact, I'd say this is one of my favorite interviews so far on the podcast. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another new episode of RPM 45.